Het is bijna. Sterker nog, het is eigenlijk in mei natuurlijk meditatie. Ik hoop dat je dat weet. koekeroe.nl/meditatie. Maar we beginnen eigenlijk met Mr. Meditation. Zondag eerder. Koen de Jong ook. En dan op 1 mei gelijk echt top met alle knallers. Van Jan Geurts tot Michael Pilacic. En van Swami tot Marjolein Berendsen. Van Robert Bridgman tot, nou ja, zo kan ik ze alle 20 weer gaan opnoemen. Maar ik wil alleen maar zeggen, als je dit hoort, is het nog geen mei. Maar is het wel al bijna zover. Dus meld je aan. koekeroe.nl/meditatie.
All right, it's a pleasure and it's an honor to have this guy who went with me on a trip, not in real life, but you have to know Michael. I'm glad you're here. Welcome in the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So during the beginning of this year, I went for a big world trip with my then girlfriend, now my wife. And this was great because I was reading your first book, The Comfort Crisis, and I was, in Japan and was reading about forest bathing, which I actually did, and you were writing about that. And then I went to New Zealand with a camper van, and, well, then I was, almost every evening was reading your adventure during your trip in Alaska. My trip in New Zealand wasn't that uncomfortable, but I was learning a lot. Actually, what I learned for you, and I really did, it was the 3-day effect. And that was a great thing because I was traveling and I was still using my phone a lot, making photos, texting with people. And of course, I was enjoying the nature. But then I wrote your book and it was about the 3-day effect. So I thought, okay, I have to put off my phone for 3 days. And now, and it was in a great moment of that trip as well. But for me now, it's one of the most beautiful things in New Zealand. And then we come to your new book, because then, okay, the 3-day it was over, and I still put on my phone again, and at that point I thought, why is it? Because immediately I was like for an hour checking news, radio things, which is my work, and I thought, why? And now there's your new book, The Scarcity Brain. How do I pronounce it?
Scarcity.
Scarcity. Mm-hmm. And well, it's about this. So a bit in Dutch. Michael Easter, hij schreef het boek The Comfort Crisis. Hij is een journalist. Hij heeft voor de Men's Health dingen gedaan. En Vice bijvoorbeeld. En op een gegeven moment was er een gast die hem uitdaagde. Ga je mee naar Alaska? Hij denkt, okay, waarom niet? Ik probeer wel eens wat. Heeft hij 5 maanden lang in Alaska survived. En daar gaat het boek over. The Comfort Crisis, over het oncomfortabele. En nu gaat het over zijn nieuwe boek. Gaat dus over hoe wij gewired zijn en hoe schaarste in ons zit. En dat is dus weer, talking about my phone and my addiction. It's all about our brain and how we are wired. And we're going to talk about both books in one conversation, of course. But I was thinking, all right, now Michael Easter is living the good life. He knows what to do, live uncomfortable and your wild, happy self, healthy self. But, when I was reading your new book, I thought, okay, he's back to his normal routines with the phone and the alcohol drinking. And so when was the moment you thought, okay, I'm going to write a new book?
Well, so I was in the process of finishing The Comfort Crisis, and I had to turn that book in May of 2020. Mm-hmm. So this was about 2 months in the pandemic. And you notice in the pandemic that sort of what everyone did is everyone freaks out. And what do we do when we freak out? Because we hear, oh, we're not going to have enough toilet paper. We're not going to have enough hand sanitizer. We're not going to have enough of all these things. So everyone runs to the grocery stores, right? And there's brawls in the aisles. I mean, it's just a war zone to amass and get as much stuff as we can. And then soon after that, people start doing all kinds of online shopping. You see screen time go up across the board. You see all these unhealthy behaviors spike, and you see a lot of healthy behaviors drop. And so a lot of it was wondering, you know, why is that? What is the sort of deeper reason? What is pushing that? And it led to this book, The Scarcity Brain, which I argue humans are very susceptible to what I would call scarcity. So when we think we don't have enough, we reach for more, we overconsume. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we tend to always assume we don't have enough.
Yeah.
We are the type of creature that is never really satisfied. So when you think about how the world has changed, it's like in the past, the average person, you know, even 200 years ago, you might own a few things. You might have some items that were handed down to you. The average home today in the US at least has 10,000 items. We throw out in the US, we throw out a third of the food that we produce. We have so much food.
Yeah.
We throw out a third of it. And in the past, most people were hungry most of the time. Like your life was an act of getting food.
Yeah.
On and on and on. Now, what's interesting though, and why I started thinking sort of about what got me sort of deeper down this rabbit hole is that I live in Las Vegas.
Huh.
So if your listeners are familiar with Las Vegas, it's
about one thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the gambling capital of the world. And, you see a lot of weird things in this town. I mean, you know, it's kind of like built on vice and,
yeah,
and all that. But the weirdest thing is slot machines.
Yeah.
So our casinos are filled with slot machines. 90% of the gambling floor is slot machines. But what's even stranger is that grocery stores, gas stations, restaurants, bars, the airport.
Yeah, I was thinking when you come in the airport, you already see them. Yeah, it's crazy.
You walk off your off the jetway of your plane, and you're basically in a casino filled with slot machines. Is the airport. And these slot machines, so they're everywhere and they don't sit empty. As people play them around the clock. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be getting groceries at 7 a.m. on a Tuesday, and there'll be like five people playing slot machines at the grocery store, at the market. And it doesn't make any sense because everyone knows the house always wins, right? The longer you play, you're never going to make money. You're never going to profit on a slot machine. Everyone knows that. So it's like, why do people do this thing that they do over and over and over, they know is going to hurt them in the long run? So I start thinking about this. I want to know, okay, why do people like slot machines? The first people I talk to are the scientists who basically research problem gambling. And they give me all these answers that it turns out are just terrible answers. So they basically tell me, they're like, oh, well, casinos don't have clocks in them. And slot machines only play in the note of C. And people like the note of C. It makes us feel more relaxed and spend more money. But if you go into an actual casino, it's like, yeah, there's not clocks everywhere, but like no other business just has clocks everywhere.
Exactly.
Like it's not a common practice to have clocks everywhere in a business. And then I even call like this slot machine audio composer guy. And I'm like, hey, you make music for slot machines.
All in C?
Yeah. Do you use them all in C? And he's like, no, where the hell did you hear that? You know? Yeah. So the problem is that I was going to these people that want us to stop gambling, right? And what I needed to do is talk to people who want you to start gambling. You got to follow the money, basically. Yeah. So this leads me to this place called Blackfire Innovation. And this is a casino in Las Vegas. It's the most cutting edge casino in town. It's got the nicest everything, nicest rooms, nicest games, nicest everything. But the public isn't welcome.
No.
This is a casino laboratory. So the gambling industry has partnered with big technology companies like Adobe, HP, Intel, all these big tech companies to build this casino where they can study human behavior. So they're doing things like figuring out, okay, how does a person's drink order at the coffee bar affect how they're going to gamble later? How much will people bet if they have a real human dealer versus an AI dealer? All these different things, try and figure out how do we get people to gamble more? How do we push people into more? So back to the slot machines. I meet with a guy who designs slot machines. And he basically tells me, oh, slot machines, yeah, it's very simple how they work. They work on this three-part system. And I call it the scarcity brain. It's got three parts. So one, opportunity. Two, unpredictable rewards. Three, quick repeatability. So opportunity to get something of value. unpredictable rewards, meaning you know if you just keep doing this behavior, you're going to get that thing, but you don't know when, and you don't know how big it's going to be. And then quick repeatability, you can just repeat the behavior and over and over. So think, just go back to the slot machine. You have an opportunity to win money. You play. You don't know if you're going to lose it. You don't know if you're going to win a few quarters. You don't know if you're going to win a life-changing amount of money. And you can play and play and play.
And that's
this tends to hook people.
And that's, I was reading it and I was like, wow, the unsure of the reward, that's what it's all about. So you mentioned, for example, in the book, and which is insane, that if you, maybe you can explain it better, but if you do a thing where you can get electricity shock, when it's like a real heavy shock, but you know every time it's the same heavy shock, then okay, you will used to it and it's okay. But when it is the, well, the unpredictable thing, then it's like, oh, what's it going to be? Yes. And maybe it's even less shocking, well, literally, but that's how it works. That's when the dopamine spikes the best, the unpredictable thing.
We hate not knowing and we want to resolve uncertainty, basically. But obviously, so there's these big tech companies invested in this casino lab. It's like none of these companies make slot machines, so why do they care? And that's because you can put this three-part behavior system called the scarcity loop into all sorts of other products and institutions to get people to repeat behaviors. So when you start to sort of unpack where this thing is, it's so many places. It makes social media work because you think about, okay, you post, you have an opportunity to get status. You don't know how many likes you're going to get. Could be like one or two likes and like, that kind of sucks. Or it could be so many likes. You could go viral. And oh my God, that feels good. That changed my life, right? And you can check and recheck as much as you like. You can post and repost. It's in dating apps. So swipe, 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 swipe. Am I going to match? Oh my God, I matched with someone. This is amazing. Swipe, 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 right? Yeah. You can just repeat that.
And it's cycle so, forever. It's insane. It's bad. It's toxic because of course, for example, Instagram, and a lot of the listeners will use it. Normally, how many likes or how many reactions? Of course, they could do it automatic, but it's really like a slot machine that if you open the app, you have to refresh for a bit, and then it's like, oh.
Yeah.
There's
a slight pause. The slight pause is programmed in.
Yeah.
So when you refresh, it's not like they're there and your results are there instantly. There's a pause because that pause is just like when the reels on the slot machine are falling. Yeah. That's what gambling is. Gambling isn't when you learn whether you've won or lost. It's when you're waiting to learn whether you've won or lost. And this, the system is, it's in gig work jobs, for example. So Uber and Instacart, I don't know if you have that. These type of jobs, the apps are using the scarcity loop to push their workers to work longer hours, to drive into places they otherwise may not. Elements of this game are being used in that. It's used in YouTube, for example. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is sort of random rewards, waiting, pushing people into autoplay so they'll quickly repeat, and kind of throwing at them things that they know that will be sort of, what's the next one? What's going to be more rewarding to increase the time that you spend watching YouTube, because that's how you make money advertising.
Yeah. But okay, you say, and we all know, our brains are designed to scan and prioritize scarcity cues. Our minds are less efficient. We're talking about lack of time, money, calories, all those things. So we're fucked, actually. Yeah. So, yeah, of course, it's good to say enough is enough, but... Yeah, well, let's go to the big question and the answer. If it's there, how do we get out of that loop? Because we're wired that way.
Yeah. There's three ways to stop this scarcity loop. And you stop it by basically taking away any one of the three parts of it. So you can take the opportunity away. Mm-hmm. It could be like, you know, if it's a slot machine, you can no longer win. But you can apply that to a lot of different things that have it. The rewards can start becoming predictable. Mm-hmm. Or three, you can slow the process down. So if you think about, let's say you want to apply it to using social media, you could try and figure out a way where you have to encounter something of a pause before you can even open and load the app. So there's apps that you can install on your phone, which it sounds crazy to install an app so you use another app less. But they actually work because you're slowing down the process. And this is one thing that's so interesting about this scarcity loop is it doesn't just work on humans. It works in every single animal. So you can pretty much pretty reliably turn a pigeon into a degenerate gambler by giving them a slot machine-like game. They will choose to play the slot machine-like game over a game that gets them a predictable amount of food. And the only way you can really reverse that is you start to make the game predictable, and then who the hell wants to pay that, play that? Because it's that becomes work, right? That is what work is it's you're doing this predictable level of labor and you're getting a predictable amount of reward back in the form of a salary. And that's boring. So unpredictable rewards are what's fun and exciting, really.
But do you think that we, well, can use it in a good way? That was what I was thinking. I don't know. How spiritual are you?
Me? I mean, I'm pretty spiritual.
Yeah. So don't you think if and of course we're talking about money and food, but in a certain way, and maybe it sounds like a hippie, but we all are, well, wanting for love and connection. So I was thinking, I don't know how, but what if we can use that loop for love and connection?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you why we are so attracted to it in the first place. And once you understand that, you can start to figure out, okay, well, how can I use it? So this loop evolved as a sort of quirk in the human brain that we get captured by it because it helped us survive in the past by helping us find food.
Mm-hmm.
So let's pretend it's 2 million years ago. I mean, back in those days, life was essentially an act of like, find food, have kids, don't die. Those were our three goals, right?
Yeah.
And so there's not much food. We need food or else we're going to starve. So we have to go search the land for it. We got to walk out and find it. So we go to point A, let's say. There's no food there. Okay. Got to go to point B. Oh, nothing there. Got to go to point C. Oh my God, nothing there. Point D, jackpot. There's all kinds of food there. So this is just like a slot machine, right?
Yeah, it's
like
unpredictable.
Search,
yeah.
Right? Unpredictable.
Yeah.
So that seems to be sort of almost hammered into our brain as something that we fall into in order to reinforce that food finding thing, which we did for 2.5 million years until we started, you know, inventing Doritos and food like that.
Yeah.
So it still captivates our brain. But this is sort of a longer way of saying, if you think about in the past, as we found food, we were out in nature, we were with people, we were exercising, we were doing all these other things that are good for us. So you can still use elements of the loop to help you get more, I would say, engaged with things that are good for you. So something like birding, right? You don't know, you're out looking for birds. You don't know when you're seeing them. You don't know what they're going to be, but you're going to do it. And yeah, along the way, you're outside, you're walking around, you're probably with people. Fishing is another example.
Yeah.
But also I think even in you know, day-to-day life in a city, it's like you could go out into a city and be like, okay, I'm going to go for a long walk and I'm going to look for this one thing. I'm going to go on this search. It could be like a rare book. So it's like, I'm going to the part of town with all the bookstores. I want to find this one book. Like that is the search, right? You don't know if you're going to find it.
No.
When you find it, it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. I found my book. But to your point about love is I do think so. I'll tell you that this is like the opposite of love, but people get hooked on bad relationships that are hot and cold because of the scarcity.
Yeah.
So if you think about someone who's in a bad relationship with someone who is abusive, they tend to stay longer than they should because it's like you hang out with the person one time and they're great. Oh, that was so much fun. And the next time, oh, they're a jerk. Like, what's going on? And so you try again. Oh, they're a jerk again. Well, what happened? Why isn't this person nice? They're nice the next time. You're like, oh, jackpot, I won. So people tend to get hooked into that cycle. So if you can identify that, if you're in a bad relationship, at least you can go, oh, well, that's why I'm so obsessed with this person, because they're hot and cold, and it falls into the scarcity loop. And then I could just be like, yeah, that's not working for me anymore. Sorry, I got to take off and find someone who's not a jerk and is nice all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that brings us back to the phone and the social media, because of course, we all know, oh, why are people so angry and bad on social media? But we're still, well, reading it and checking it. And that's, well, even in a bad relationship, it's like, it's about the connection. It's not a good connection. So I was reading one of your last posts on Instagram, which is a few months ago, and I thought, oh, great. It's not even more a big thing in your life. But on the other hand, well, you have a mission. You have a book. And you were there at Joe Rogan and posting about it, and you were saying, and I loved it. Oh yeah, there's threats, and we don't have it yet in Europe, but it's Instagram, and it's, like you said, another meth-like social app. How do you work with this? Because, well, like I said, you are on a mission, and for example, this podcast, it's so crazy because a lot of times I'm sharing a part on social media why you shouldn't be on your phone all day. So it's a little bit confusing in my life. How do you work with that yourself?
Yeah, I think about it in terms of, so if you go back to that first part of the loop, it's opportunity.
Yeah.
So what is my opportunity? Now, the game that social media wants you to play is to get likes, to get retweets, to get engagement, to get views, to do all these things to basically keep others engaging with your content longer.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily have to play that game. You can say, okay, here's the goal of me posting. The goal of me posting is not to get likes. It is to spread a certain kind of information, right? For an example, another example, it's to find like-minded individuals to connect with in the real world. It's to create a network of friends where we communicate. Like, you can decide how you want to use social media. You just have to be vigilant about keeping that goal the goal, because it is very easy to get sucked in, and you might have to change who you follow. You might have to, you know, when Instagram starts sending you, you know, they know, Instagram knows that I love videos of dogs.
Yeah,
they just know. So I'm like, you know, when I've blown 20 minutes watching dog videos, I'm like, oh my God, I need to do the, you know, show me less content of dogs, please. Cause I know the dogs are just going to suck me in every time.
Yeah. Yeah. But is it hard for you? Because it sounds almost for me too good to be true. And I'm aware of this and busy with those themes, but yeah, to be honest, when I post something about my podcast, yeah, I'm checking the likes, I'm checking the reactions, mm-hmm. and I feel loved and I feel bad and I, well, yeah.
And I think that it's funny because I've sort of changed I used to kind of think the answer to use tech less is to always use tech less.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's some interesting new apps and technologies that can help people use tech less. So I'll give you an example. There was one, there's an app called ClearSpace.
Mm-hmm.
And this is invented by these two kids who are, you know, concerned with how much time we spend on social media. And they really have made it a device that slows down the repetition. So you choose how many times am I going to go into this app a day.
Mm-hmm.
So you've made a decision beforehand, right? It's not that you were okay, in there and you got sucked in. So you've got, okay, three times. And then when you load it up, you have to go through a series of steps and it really slows things down. And it even has a feature where it's like, okay, before you can get into Instagram, I want you to take a deep breath. I want you to relax for a minute. And then you go, and then it asks you, how much time do you want to spend here? Because you might load the app normally and be like, I'm going to spend 2 minutes. And then 20 minutes later, you know, like me, you're on your 50th dog video. So it'll ask you, how much time do you want to spend? And you can say, okay, I want to spend 5 minutes. You get your 5 minutes, you go in, you do what you need to do, and then the app just straight up cuts off after 5 minutes. So you get three times like that a day. And I think that will help people. I think those sorts of technologies, ClearSpace is the best that I've used.
Yeah.
I think that's really useful.
Yeah, it sounds great because it's almost like, well, you were talking about gamification in your book, and we all know that works. And this is, well, kind of like make a game of your use of social media and use it in a great way. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I don't think it's all negative.
Of course not. No.
You know, you and I have connected on social media. I've connected with a lot of people I don't know on social media that are interesting. I've had some good interactions. Obviously not everything is good.
No.
I wasted a lot of time there too. I talk to people who are not, let's say they're not positive people in my life. You know, they're kind of trolls. They insert themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really, really having to think about the use of it and realizing we're probably never going to have a perfect solution because it's a highly imperfect platform. Most platforms are. But just trying to get better at it every day.
Yeah. Can you describe a typical morning? So my question is always the same. Do you have like a morning routine or a morning ritual?
It's very simple. I get up, I make coffee, and then I start writing. And I write for, you know, three to four hours.
And is this like, this almost sounds like Julia Cameron's The Artist Way, just write whatever you feel, or is it like work writing?
It's work writing. So normally, in the past, it would be working on my books. I now devote a lot of my time and energy into, I have a Substack that goes out three times a week.
It's the 2% called 2%
with Michael Easter. Yep. It's twopct.com as a website. So I spend a lot of time doing that and I find that enjoyable. I think that for me, when I think about morning routines, my approach is always, what is my larger goal that I'm trying to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
And if something doesn't help me accomplish that larger goal, it probably doesn't belong in my morning routine. So some people, you know, they will perform better at whatever their goal is if they, you know, spend 10 minutes meditating or something when they wake up. For me, I find that my time is best spent just going right into writing.
It's a great thing because in the beginning of your new book, you're talking about, well, not really routines, but new habits. And well, my podcast is about self-development and spirituality. So of course, I talk a lot about these things. And you say, and this is great, I'm particularly interested in how can we resolve the behaviors that hurt us most. So not making new routines and new habits, which is always great, but it's about, you say here, it doesn't matter how much gas we give good new habits. If we don't resolve our bad ones, we still have our foot on the brake. And this is about the scarcity brain we're talking about.
I think it's a better return on your time invested to clear up the things that are holding you back than if you're still held back and you're just adding more stuff. You're just adding more stress and you still haven't, you're not devoting your time in a way that would give you the most return on your time invested.
No. But it's like a thin line. You were saying about how many things a general household have. And I was thinking about the whole minimalistic thing, which I know where it comes from. But in a certain way, it can be like a new addiction as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, no. I have 10 things and not more than 10 things. And then it's like, like I said, it's the same thing then.
Yeah, I talked to, for the book Scarcity Brain, I talked to a woman who studies hoarding. So she's a professor at the University of Michigan. And she talked to me about how hoarding, when we think about it in terms of getting a bunch of items, the reason people hoard is usually some underlying problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like they have anxiety, they've got, you know, stress, depression, and they deal with it by purchasing too much stuff, saving too much stuff. But she said, on the other hand, is this trend of minimalism, which is the same type of deal.
Exactly.
It's just the opposite expression of it. It's that they've got anxiety, they've got stress, they've got maybe depression, and they think that, like, if I can just have my space very sparse and perfect, everything in its perfect location, my problem will go away. But you haven't solved the underlying problem, right? The answer there is to be like, well, maybe this has nothing to do with items in my house. Maybe there's something else I need to solve here. Because if you don't, and you see I don't know if this was a trend in where you are, but in the US, there people always go through, I buy too much stuff. And when I realize I have too much stuff, I do the whole purge minimalism thing.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, good. But then I start slowly buying more stuff. And then I do it again. And it's just this big cycle.
Yeah.
Right? It's just this constant cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in a certain way, the whole pandemic was, I think it was a positive thing besides all the bad things. And of course, the people died. But I mean, like, people were really, I don't know if it was over there, but I guess it was like a worldwide thing. Of course, people were buying things online, but even more people were cleaning out all the closets, and well, hopefully also their mind. What do you think about that? Do you think it was a good time in the end for the world?
I think that it helped a lot of, I mean, I guess we're, it depends on who we're talking about,
yeah,
right? Exactly. I think that it kind of depends on what your particular situation was in the pandemic, but I do think that for a lot of people, it was a good wake-up call.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people changed jobs for
in
the better.
In a certain way, it wasn't a comfort living. So talking about your first book, The Comfort Crisis,
yeah.
We were all in like a crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. We have to, humans often have to, you know, we're really good at sort of living in the space of mediocrity, I guess I would call it, where it's like, things aren't good, but they're not that bad.
No.
So like, why change it? And it's not until things get really bad that we go, oh, we need to actually make a change. And so I do think that for a lot of people, that was the pandemic. It was sort of a wake up call, like, what the hell am I doing with my life?
Yeah.
Do I really want to live in this 300 square foot apartment in New York City with, you know, garbage trucks beneath me, keeping me up all night? Or should I, you know, maybe be spending more time outdoors?
Yeah.
That leads to maybe moving. And I think in a lot of ways it was good. I mean, I think for everyone, there was downsides.
Yeah, of course.
And there was upsides. Yeah. I think it just depends, you know, where you sat. Hopefully you had more upsides rather than downsides.
Yeah. Do you have like an evening routine?
Evening routine. That is a great question. I haven't gotten that one. I've gotten questions about morning routines,
yeah.
But not evening routines. I like the idea of evening routine. Yeah. So my wife and I will usually eat dinner together. And if I have work and she has work, we'll usually do some work after dinner, but we'll work together. Like I'll sit and crank out emails on the couch. And then we will usually watch a show that we've agreed on, or we'll even play, and this is kind of new, we've started to play video games, oddly enough.
Oh.
So there's these video games where they're called cooperative games. So you need two people to play, to work together as they play them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's actually really fun because I think both of us were like, someone suggested this to us and both of us were kind of like, video games, that's for nerds.
Yeah.
And we're like, let's just try it, you know? And it's actually really fun. You kind of have to like work together and be engaged together because it is easy if you're just watching a TV show. You're kind of like, you're both just in your own little world,
yeah,
right? Yeah, yeah. So
okay.
That's kind of the standard evening routine. And then on the weekends, we usually go to concerts or do something fun like that.
Well, I ask this because what I've really learned, and like I said, the first book I was reading in nature, but your new book as well, for me, it's like an eye-opener maybe I knew already, but like awake. I should be more in nature. So I thought, well, that's what you learn especially the first book. So I thought maybe you go on a daily walk or maybe you have a dog. I don't know.
Yeah. So after, I will say that after I'm done writing, I
take my
dogs on a walk. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
After I'm done writing in the morning, I take my dogs on a walk, usually out in the desert. I'll usually bring my phone in case my dog decides to get bit by a rattlesnake. We need, you know, emergency. But yeah, I go for usually about 40 to 60 minutes and try to just zone out. It's some time to get bored, to think, to sort of run through problems in the back of my mind, to space out and just take in nature. Because I live right on the edge of the desert. So there's this amazing protected desert right by my house. That you guys probably see in the, you know, nice pictures about the American Southwest.
Yeah,
that's right in my backyard. So it's nice.
Because, well, nature is the whole unpredictable thing about it. And that's what the comfort crisis is about. But also how the scarcity brain works, it's almost like a great solution for... for a lot of...
Yeah, because I don't, you know, every walk out there is different. I don't know what it's going to be like. You know, I might get this amazing sunrise where you're like, it's just so amazing that you're like, oh my God, I'm so glad I'm here right now.
Yeah.
You know, and unpredictability is inherent to nature. And I think that it would do a lot of good for us if we tried to leverage that to make nature more engaging for people and really realize that like, that's why you go out there, because anything can happen and it's going to happen in a place that you've had to get there by foot You're going to get some good mental health benefits, spending more time in nature, all these different things. Good things happen when we go outside and we move through the outdoors.
Exactly. And then besides writing, are you reading a lot as well? So my question is, what are the three books that, well, made you Michael Easter as you are now? En maybe helped you with the books or with your life or whatever. Oh, sorry, ik onderbreek eventjes dit fijne gesprek. Maar dat is vanwege iets dat met boeken te maken heeft. En ja, ik hou van boeken. Ik hou van verhalen, van lezen, maar ook van luisteren. Vooral als je onderweg bent of gewoon, weet ik veel wat aan het doen bent. En ik heb nu iets tof met de vrienden van Next Story. Daar vind je echt op die site, jongen, 300.000 boeken. Dus ook zeker de boeken die net besproken zijn. En ik mag je nu, en dat is echt wel een toffe actie, 50 dagen gratis aanbieden. Ja, die gasten die geloven gewoon wel in zichzelf. Dus die denken, oké, dan hebben we ze. Maar dat kan je echt even checken. Ga naar koekeroe.nl/boekenkast. Daar vind je sowieso alle boeken die besproken zijn in de afgelopen afleveringen. En daar vind je dus ook een link. En via die link kan je 50 dagen gratis Next Story gebruiken. Check het, koekeroe.nl/boekenkast.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So I would say, I can think of three. Mm-hmm. I really liked Story of the Human Body by Dan Lieberman, which is basically about why did humans evolve to be the way we are? Why are we built the way we are? Why are our bodies designed as they are? Because I think that that can inform us today about a lot of health problems we're now facing.
No.
Number two.
Talking about this book, I think it's great. And that's maybe, I don't know if that's in the book, but you learned it to me in your first book. That we are like one of the best creatures of all time. And I have to look this up. Because of the fact we can do it for so long.
We can. So humans are not athletically gifted at most things. Like we're not fast. We can't jump. We can't juke really quickly. We suck at climbing. But we are really good at covering long distances on foot, often while carrying weight. So the reason the human body is built the way it is so we could run long distances in the heat. We're really good at cooling ourselves. We're really efficient with our use of energy. And we would run down animals in the heat for miles and miles. We'd slowly bump them. And eventually those animals who are not good at cooling themselves would overheat. And then we would spear them, we would kill them, and we would have dinner. Yeah. And then we would have to do the next thing that we're good at, which is carrying. We'd have to carry the animals back to camp. So we're the only animal that can carry weight for long distances. So these are like the two acts that really shaped us into who we are, allowed us to survive, allowed us to eventually travel into the unknown with tools and take over the world, basically.
Yeah, well, this was the part where I thought, yeah, we're like team human. We are like the motherfuckers who rule the world, of course. But in a certain way, sometimes you think, oh, we're not as fast as or whatever. But thanks for this. And
do you know the animal that is the best endurance animal, mammal?
No.
It is sled dogs. So, but they can't do it in the heat. That's what we're good at. So sled dogs in the winter, their VO2 max, I think, goes up to like 180 on average, and they can cover 100 miles in a day running about 4-minute miles, and they'll do it for 30 days straight. I mean, they're phenomenal endurance athletes, but if you put them at the equator in any type of heat, they'll literally overheat in like 20 minutes. Done.
But not in heat, the story of a human body. And when was the moment you read that book? Were you like a young guy or?
I was probably 27, 28. I'm 36 now. So a lot of it is I had been an editor at Men's Health Magazine for a long time and had been thinking about health and fitness for a while. And I think it was particularly Dan Lieberman's work and the work of a few other people that got me thinking about sort of these larger timescales of like, what are humans supposed to be good at?
Yeah.
And how can that guide our thinking about health and living better today?
Yeah. So would you call yourself a biohacker or not at all?
Not really. I don't do too. I mean, part of it is because I associate kind of strange far out experiments with biohackers, you know, like I'm going to inject this strange substance into my body because I read a study on rats. Like, I'm not interested.
No, okay.
But I would say that I am interested in thinking about how humans today can live better. And my own perspective is less leveraging sort of brand new science to bring us into ideal health. It's mm-hmm. more thinking about our past and what we're designed to do and what has made humans healthy and happy for millions of years. And how can I leverage that and put it back into my life? Because really what's changed is our environment, right? Our environment now is very comfortable. It's we don't have to put in as much effort. We're surrounded in food all the time. We don't spend as much time in nature. We're attached to screens for more than 12 hours a day. Like, that is really what has affected our health. Not so much that we don't have, you know, some special peptide that we're shooting into our leg every day.
No. Great. Okay, so this was the first book. What's your second book?
It would be Under the Banner of Heaven. So this is a book by John Krakauer. And the reason that that is my second book is because I'm a journalist who, you know, I write these long books that kind of deal with a big topic and they weave together different stories.
Yeah.
And this book, in my opinion, is the absolute best at doing this. So it more or less tells the history of the Mormon Church told through this murder that happened in, I think it was in the early 80s, and the history of polygamy. The Mormon Church. And it's just so well done. The stories go back and forth and the history and the reporting is done in a way, you know, it could sound boring at face value, but the way he writes it, it's the most amazing book ever. Like it's one book that I can remember. I sat down and I started reading it and I looked up, you know, 5-6 hours later and I was done.
Yeah, great. Well, yeah. It's a good point of, well, giving you compliments about both books because that's how you work. It's like you are willing to find an answer on a question in your life. And then sometimes you think, okay, why do I have to know all the details about this guy sitting in a bakery or something? And then it all appears and like, oh yeah. And then you go back to Iraqi again. And then we are still in the casino. It's great, Michael. It's a pleasure to read the first book, of course. Well, going to Alaska, and we all want to know, okay, how is it going to be, and will he see a bear? Well, no spoiler at all. Read the book if you haven't read it. And well, in your new book, that's well the same thing again. So now, well, I understand why you mentioned this book then, because that's a really well new way of writing, and since you're like. A science journalist, and normally it's like really well business wise. Your colleagues, they write more like, okay, this is the case. This is a
mm-hmm.
So well, compliments for that because that's really fun to read.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. I definitely have fun writing my book, so I'm glad to hear people have fun reading them.
Yeah. But before we go to the third book, talking about this, well, well, you are a journalist. You're like, well, the busy with world things, and that's why I ask you this question: how spiritual are you? And you said, well, kind of spiritual. But in my life, because I talk about spirituality a lot, but also about biohacking and self development. How do you go on with that? Because at a certain point in your book, you're saying too much science and we lose the most important aspects of the human experience, too much soul, and we can lead ourselves into delusion. So it's how do you find your way between those things?
Thread that? Yeah. I mean, I will say that I think that some of the most important experiences in my life, they couldn't be explained by science. Like you just can't, you know, you can't do a brain scan and tell me, oh, well, it's because of this dopamine shot at him. It's like, not really that. We're like, we don't know enough yet. At the same time, I think that science can inform and help us understand why certain behaviors seem to be good for us. Right. So it's like people were observing that people who moved more lived better a long time ago.
Yeah.
We just didn't know why. So science can come in and say, well, here's why. And then we go, you get more people to go, oh, okay. Well, yeah, that seems good. And then we can develop new things based on those ideas. But I think that when we fall too far into the science camp and thinking of, you know, what a study says as effectively the capital T truth, it's like studies are not constructed that well most of the time. Like they got to make a lot of jumps. It's like you're choosing which group you're going to use. You're going to use a certain type of people. They're probably going to be Western people. It's a high likelihood they're going to be college students. It's a high likelihood. There's all these things where it just doesn't apply to everyone. And if you read studies as if they're gospel, you just miss the boat. And it's not helpful for a lot of people. You're going to miss a lot of populations. And I think it can push people away too from these experiences that aren't quite explainable, but can change a person even more profoundly. Right. So a good example would be how there's been a rise in people using psychedelics for mental health.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, well, how the hell do those work? And people would be like, well, the serotonin and the dopamine and blah, blah, blah. It's like, fuck off. Like,
yeah,
that's not, when people talk about the insights they have, that is not it. Right. There's something there that is sort of deeper and currently unexplainable. And so that's why I say, you know, balance science with soul. You got to have science on one hand, but also you can't treat it like it's gospel. And you have to understand that there are things we don't know and be willing to accept that and even lean into it.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. And then your third book.
That would be Confederacy of Dunces. So this is a fiction book.
Okay.
And it's about this guy who lives in New Orleans with his mother. And it is, he has grandiose views of himself. And it is the funniest book you will ever read.
Okay.
And it's just so entertaining and hilarious that it's made me try and think about. So one of my rules for life is rule number 62, which is don't take yourself so damn seriously. And so this book totally fits into that. And it's just hilarious. I always think, because I'm writing about, you know, science and how to live better and kind of balancing the topics we just talked about. But ultimately, like if something isn't entertaining, it's like people aren't going to read it. So like you can't take yourself super serious, you know, or else you kind of lose people. And so I think that was an important book for me to realize you can be like writing can be fun and you can say funny things.
Wow. And when was the moment you read that book for the first time?
I probably read that book for the first time when I was maybe 14.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was an early one.
Okay. I want to, go to some specific things in both of your books. First, talk about pride, which is a good thing. Sometimes it is. So maybe you can explain what the thing, what the difference is between authentic pride and what do you call it? Hubristic pride?
Hubristic pride, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that pride is often a good thing. It's this positive feeling we get that reinforces doing good things. But the issue is that there's two different kinds of pride. There's authentic pride. So this comes from actually doing big, good things and having them work out. Mm-hmm. And you get this internal feeling of like, oh, that feels great. Now, if other people see you do that thing, then it feels even better. Because now you get like some social boost, right? Mm-hmm. Hubristic pride is sort of falsely advertising yourself as a person who does great things and is great. So you may not necessarily get anything internal from it. It is entirely to try and get the approval of other people. And you find that people who display too much hubristic pride, it doesn't serve them well in the long term. Basically, they might get an edge up status-wise in the short term, but they tend to fall in the long term because people eventually learn to sniff out their bullshit and it, you know, it drives people crazy. And I think bringing it back to sort of the concept of the book, which is that, you know, in the past, I think if you were, you know, in the small tribes that we evolved in and you could only get status from so many people, right? It's like, you're only trying to advertise yourself to like 100 people.
Yeah.
And they all know you. You know, if you're trying to like puff your chest, they're like, give me a break, dude. We all know you, you know? But now with the rise of the internet, you can display this hubristic pride to millions of people with a click of a button. And people may not know whether or not, you know, you're full of it or you're deserving of it. And I think what this can do is it can artificially inflate some people who probably shouldn't have as big of a public platform as they do. I think also that you can, it also just makes you maybe look bad in the long run in mm-hmm. some cases. Like, you know, now you can be a jerk in front of millions of people instead of just 100. And so, yeah, it's just a much wider net we can cast for pride.
Yeah. And for example, talking about yourself, when your book was finished, you felt that, well, pride feeling. Of course, you want to have world, that is going to be a bestseller. But even without other people reading your book, you were proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, to me, the takeaway for the average person is no matter what you're doing, do it in a way that you will feel good about it, that you think you've done the best job, and you will be, if no one else hears about this thing, if no one else sees it, you will be like, hell yeah, I stand behind that. Because that is likely going to increase the likelihood that when people do see it or come across it, it'll resonate more with them.
And then it's a thing in your first book, and for you, that's a long time ago. But you are you still hunting?
I am, yep.
Okay.
Yeah, every fall.
Yeah, oh, every fall, okay. So this is a thing, I don't know if I pronounce it right, but it's misogi.
Yeah, misogi.
Misogi.
Yeah.
What is misogi?
Misogi is a epic physical task that you take on in nature once a year. And the two rules are make it really hard, which is defined by saying you should have a 50-50 shot at finishing whatever your misogi task is. So real 50-50 shot, because you think about today, when people take on challenges, they usually know they're going to complete them.
Yeah.
Right? They pick something that'll be challenging, but they're like, yeah, I'll finish it. Now, this is like true 50-50. You don't know if you can finish it. And then rule two is don't die, which is basically saying, you know, take water, don't be dumb, put some safety nets in.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
And is that a yearly thing for you as well?
Yeah, it is. I usually try and do one a year.
Yeah. And we all know, and maybe this is a bit scary for a lot of listeners, but we all know that, well, when there's something new and there's something a little bit dangerous, we're all so aware. And well, that's, for example, for me, what meditation is all about, like feeling, listening, hearing. And well, that is the kind of state, where you are in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, when I say 50-50, that means that it's anyone can do it. Like my mother, who's 70 something, she's taking on these challenges. Of course, she's not out there running 100 miles, but she's doing things that are hard for her, which might be, you know,
yeah, exactly.
It's walking 5 miles and then letting that. The important part is that you don't do the thing just to do the thing. You do the thing to learn that you're capable of more than you thought. Because in a well-designed misogi, you will inevitably hit a point where you think, I cannot go past this. Like, I have reached my edge. We are at the edge.
Yeah.
But if you put one foot in front of the other repeatedly, you get a second moment.
Yeah.
That second moment is where you can look back and say, well, wait a minute. I thought my edge was back there, but I'm clearly past it. So I've undersold myself here, right? And then the important question, which you need to walk away with, you need to ask this question or else it's not going to help you, is where else in my life am I selling myself short? And that changes you. Because then you can take that back into your normal life and go, okay, I'm capable of more than I thought.
Yeah.
And that can move the dial.
Great. And well, talking about the scarcity brain, talking about the unpredictable reward. Well,
yeah,
that's with this again.
Yeah, exactly. It's unpredictable.
Yeah.
So you get more attached to it. There's a lot more intrigue comes from that and you get more internal rewards from that, I think.
Are you already busy with a new theme, a new book, a new...
Yeah, you know, I've been working on a proposal and my editor and I are having a lot of conversations about what the book will be. And we've both changed our minds and redirected the thing about 5 different times. So it's going at a snail's pace. It'll hit 20,000 words and then we'll delete 10,000 and that'll hit 30,000 words and we'll delete 15. And so it's... fits and starts.
But can you share the big theme?
I don't know if we have it yet. I mean, I think I want to do a book about longevity, but you know, why do we want to live longer in the first place?
Mm.
And to me, it's because, you know, we spend so much time focusing on how am I going to get more years in the future? But in order to do that, we often do things that make us miserable in the time we have right now. And so how do you balance those things? And what have people done? I think there's a lot of value for me as a journalist, being someone that goes and seeks out answers from people who think about this and looking at different competing theories and having to weigh them and sort of thinking about what are the highest return things I can do to live better today in order to have more tomorrows, more or less.
Yeah, great. Because we all, and well, you as a journalist even more, and well, me myself, I think as well, we are all informophores, like human beings.
Yes.
We are creatures that search for and digest information more, more, more.
Yes. Yeah. So I talk about that in Scarcity Brain. The book is laid out. I lay out what the scarcity loop is in the first handful of chapters. And then I explain these different areas that it affects us.
Mm-hmm.
And the areas that it affects us is the loop evolved to help us find food, but also push us into other behaviors that helped us survive in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So things like gaining information, which would give you a survival edge, things like getting possessions, which would be tools you could use to survive. Things like getting status over other people, which would get you more mates. It would get you out of crappy work. It would get you all these things, right? So we're evolved to want to crave more of those things. The scarcity loop pushes us into those. But all of those things I just listed are now, we have an abundance of all of them,
mm-hmm.
right? We have a million things we could buy on Amazon Prime at any moment.
Yeah.
We have the Google and the internet and Twitter and libraries full of information. The average person today sees more information in one day than a person 700 years ago did in their entire life. We have all these different ways to get status on social. So with us being informivores, people that crave information and seek it out, we live in this world now where anytime we have a dumb question that comes into our head, we can Google it. And we don't always get great answers because the internet is full of information from people who are seemingly smart, seemingly expert, and they might disagree entirely.
Yeah.
And it's like, how the hell do you live through that? Like, what do you do with it? Like, how do you even exist? Like, it's so hard. And so the book looks a little bit at that, how the loop affects that. And, how sometimes this drive we have to always have information can backfire on us, and just basically better ways to find information and vet it.
Yeah. But, well, on a positive hand, you're also mentioning scarcity is the mother of invention, ideas, and breaking new ground in the map of in the mind. So,
yeah.
Of course, it helped us a lot as human beings, and, well, it still will be. But we should have been more aware of the fact it's going to be vitamin or toxin, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. One thing that's interesting is when it comes to information, in the past, we would have had to go on foot and search the world to find information.
Mm-hmm.
So we're fascinating as a creature because we explore more than any other animal. Like, we conquered the world on foot.
Mm-hmm.
We're everywhere. It's crazy. But now when we want to know something, instead of having to go there in person into this unknown and learn things, it's like we can just Google it. We have all these mediated experience. Like, there's so many times where people hardly do anything today without Googling it first,
yeah.
Right? If you're going to watch a movie, I got to read the reviews. If I'm going to go to a restaurant, I got to read the menu. If I'm going to go shop at a store, I got to read the reviews on all the products. Like, oh, is this going to be good? Like, I can't just take the full plunge and enter the unknown. Right. I got to know as much information. I think that can ultimately misguide us because reviews, I don't find reviews are that helpful because everyone has different criteria for making a review, right? If you think about a restaurant, it's like, I'm going to give it this star value, but I might give it 0 stars because the food was slow. But someone who wanted the food to come out slow might give it 5 stars.
Yeah.
And then when you try and go there, and if you don't even care about the time at all, you're like, this isn't helping me at all, but you don't have that context cue.
No.
So I think trying to just have genuinely authentic new experiences can be really interesting and rewarding for people. Because you have, it's like the slot machine. It's like, you don't know what's going to happen.
No.
I picked a restaurant at random. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to see if this is any good. And it might be mediocre, whatever, but it might be this place that I discovered on my own. And it's like, oh my God, this is my place. This is my secret spot. I didn't learn this from the New York Times or the, you know, the newspaper. I didn't learn it from Yelp. Like, this place is mine. And that's cool.
That's a good thing. To be honest, I'm the guy who's reading the reviews. And most of the times I'm reading the baddest reviews because when I think, oh man, what are you talking about? If this is the baddest thing, then I'm going to check it. But you're absolutely right. It isn't that unpredictable thing anymore because we read about it too much sometimes with holidays, with restaurants. Yeah. But talking about information, and that was the part I didn't know exactly what you meant about it. You said we are Googling a lot of things. There's a lot of information. But how does it come that, well, there are now people actually thinking that the world is flat? And you read something about it, but I didn't understand that.
So I think that the world is very complicated. Things are complicated.
Yeah.
And this is sort of a metaphor for conspiracy theories. So if you think about a conspiracy theory, if you just hear how it works, you might think, well, that sounds complicated. But at the end of the conspiracy theory, it's actually very clear, right? It like explains a very complicated phenomenon in a way that people go, oh, okay, that makes sense, right? Think about like the JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. It couldn't just be that like, yeah, a guy had a gun and blah, blah, blah. Like people are like, oh, well, it couldn't just be that because that seems too straightforward. It's also kind of ambiguous. Was it him? Like, we don't know all the information. So you got to string together all these points so you can arrive at this like aha moment. So people basically trust this feeling they have that things are clear, and that can sometimes misguide us. Like the world is flat, people. Like they don't understand how the world could be a ball and blah, 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 because what I see is, you know, flatness. And so then they go on the internet and they're like, you know, is the world really round? And they're fed with this idea that like, oh, the world's flat. Here's why we think the world is flat. And it all makes sense. I mean, it's bullshit, but like the logic holds. And so people can go, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. Now that's an extreme view. But I think since you work in health and wellness, we often see it a lot in health and wellness, right? It's like you go, oh, well, like why were people more thin in the past? You know, it's like, oh God, there's got to be a reason. Like it couldn't just be that like people are eating more of anything. Like if we're looking for like a real clear thing. And it's like, oh, well, you start to see people get fatter. Like when the government started telling us to like eat a certain type of food. So it's definitely the government wanted us to be fatter. Like it's a government conspiracy, right? And then it leads to these wacky diets. Well, like if the government tells you to eat grains, you just need to eat only meat. And that's really the thing, right? So you find people start to go down these rabbit holes of
So in information a certain
that way, advertise to have the answer. And it can't just be complicated.
And that brings us back to the unpredictable part. Maybe in a certain way, the most obvious things like, we all know. But then you come up with another theory and it's like it gives you a strange feeling. And maybe... Yeah. That gives us dopamine, and that's why we all want to hear those crazy stories because of the unpredictable part of it.
Yeah, I think it's a search for information that explains something complicated.
Yeah.
Right? We want a result. Go back to that study you talked about at the beginning where people will choose to be shocked rather than not know if they're going to get shocked.
Yeah.
Just get it over with. I want the information because that'll be better. So when you have, you know, the world is complicated, like politics is very complicated. There's a million reasons, a million dominoes have to fall for something to happen. But if you don't understand all those dominoes, well, that sucks to not know. So I think conspiracies come in and basically say like, no, domino A went to domino B, went to domino C. They're all bullshit dominoes, but at least you know, oh, okay, well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Like now I feel better about this.
Okay. What do you think
And this is, well, like the science guy and the spiritual guy. I'm really curious about this, and I read something about it in your first book. What do you think about death? Are you scared about it to start with?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm scared about it. I mean, I definitely think about it. And I think that that actually helps guide my time.
Yeah.
So as part of the last book, I traveled to Bhutan because Bhutan is really interesting in that they're one of the least developed countries on earth, but they score really high in happiness.
Yeah.
And there's a handful of reasons for that. But one of them is that they have a greater awareness of death. So they're told to think about their death. Death is part of the culture. It's sort of woven into living in Bhutan. And I think that that has made them more aware of how they use their time. And I met with this monk in Bhutan, and he basically put it like this. He goes, pretend that you're walking on a trail. And on the trail, in 500 yards, is a cliff. He goes, okay, the cliff is death. You're walking towards it right now. And he goes, don't you want to know there's a cliff? Because if you know there's a cliff, then you're probably going to change how you walk the trail. Right? You're going to have different conversations with the people you're on the trail with. You're going to stop and take in the beauty of the trail. You're going to do all these different things. So I think that when we realize that we're eventually going to die, it can change our behavior. And those behavior changes can lead to positive shifts in our life.
Yeah.
How we spend our time, how we treat others, our overall stress from things that are really stupid and flippant in the grand scheme of time and space, mm-hmm. you know? And that's actually backed up by different studies as well.
And is this what you're talking about, mitakpa?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you were, and then we're going to the end, but when you say happiness, and in your new book, you're saying happiness drives the scarcity loop. But, well, for me, to be honest, happiness is like such an empty thing. And that's what I was first saying about love and connection. Don't you think it's more about that instead of happiness? Because what's happiness?
Right. I think that people worry too much about happiness when really, if you just do things that you know are good for you, that are good for others, that are going to sort of feed your soul, if you will.
Yeah.
I think you'll wind up happy.
Exactly.
But we kind of live in at least in the US, we live in a society where people kind of chase the next thing that came out of a happiness study. You know, it's like, oh, you got to be social to be happy. People are like, oh, I got to go make friends. I got to go make friends right now.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, oh, you're missing the point. So I think it's just doing what you know is good for you, doing that's what's going to help others, what's going to help the world. And then I think you find yourself happy rather than worrying about, you know, happiness as a whole.
Exactly. It's about not feeling better, but to feel better. I think when you are really crying about something in a certain way, well, that's a happy life as well, because you are living it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like having a human experience.
Exactly.
It's like you want to experience all the highs and all the lows. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you think about death? What will happen? And of course, we don't know. And it's but those one of those things we have no idea what's going on. But of course, you will. Yeah, sometimes you think about it. What do you think that happens?
I don't know what happened before we were born. Probably that.
Yeah. So what's that?
Yeah. Whatever that was.
Yeah. Okay. That's really a science professor answer. This. But you think like the energy stays or what do you think?
Well, I mean, it does in a sense that like your carbon gets recycled, to somewhere else, you know, you die, your carbon goes somewhere.
Yeah.
Where, you know, goes out into the earth, to the air. And then, yeah, I don't know. To me, it's like, I don't know, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, okay. That's a good thing. And how do you, because, well, there will be a time, and I hope you will write a lot of new books and doing great things, but at a certain point, well, something will happen. How do you want to be remembered?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if anyone, like, I think sometimes, like, I'll be honest, I think that sometimes people worry too much about how they're going to get remembered. And it's like, maybe your kids will remember you. Maybe your grandkids will. But beyond that, no one's going to remember you.
No. But on the other hand, you are writing books, man. The 2% newsletter. You are inspiring people. So in a certain way, and I'm glad with that, but you are.
Yeah. So to me, the answer is not to worry about how I am going to be remembered. It's going to be, it's worrying about how can I affect people's lives right now? Right. Because like, when's the last time you read a book from the 1700s?
Yeah.
It could have been the best book of the 1700s. And you probably didn't read it. You probably don't know who wrote that person. No. Neither does anyone else. But that book probably helped a lot of people in the 1700s. So like, worry about how you can help people alive right now, rather than like, it's just a different shift. Yeah. I mean, maybe it leads to the exact same thing, but I don't know, because it's just, I also think that realizing that, you know, people probably aren't going to remember you.
No. So okay. Like, okay. Let me transpose then this question. How do you want that people think about you now?
How do I want people to think about me now? Good question. Someone who answers podcast questions really annoyingly, apparently. I don't know, someone who tries to help people, someone who tries to be honest. I try and be as brutally honest with what I find as I can and have it help people. Yeah.
Well, I think it was a really honest conversation, and you were giving great answers. Thank you for this, Michael. Thanks for your time, and thanks for your new book and all the great things you are doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was fun. I'm glad we were able to make it happen.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Like I said, I was reading your first book and I was like, oh, I should have this guy in my podcast. And then I went on a trip and, well, there's this new book, and now... It all was there, yeah. Have you ever been to Holland?
No, I haven't. No. I'm going to have to visit.
Yeah.
I'll let you know if I do.
Yeah, okay, let me know. When you're in Amsterdam, absolutely. Thanks for your time again, and have a wonderful day, Michael.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Dit was Koekeroe. Ik ben benieuwd wat je ervan vond. Ik hoop dat je hem een beetje kon volgen. Ik zal de linkjes van de boeken even in de beschrijving zetten. Nou, ook naar zijn 2% ding, wat dat precies is. Dat zal ik daar ook bij zetten. Dus weer even een keer in het Engels, als we even wennen. Maar ik vond het een hele goede zelf, want ik heb de boeken met veel plezier gelezen. Dit was Koekeroe. Tot de volgende. Zonnegroet. Hoi. Ja, misschien word je helemaal gek van me. Sorry. Maar ik wil gewoon even zeker weten dat je je al hebt aangemeld. Want het zou zonde zijn als je het mist. Samen mediteren. Elke ochtend, elke avond. Live is gratis. En het zijn echt grote coaches die normaal gesproken, echt wel wat knaken kosten. Als ik denk aan Michael Pilacic, of Jan Geurs, of Jazzy Jazz, of Faya Laurens, of Robert Bridgman, Swami, Roy Martina, Hielke Bonnema, Merel Teunis. Er zijn nogal wat Marjoleinen, Marjolein Berendsen, Marjolein van der Aar van Mindful Minute, Marjolein Loderichs, Willem Glaudemans, Jerome Berends van BeMind, Wouter de Jong van Mind Gym. En Marieke van Meijeren, van de Bewustzijnsschool natuurlijk. Christine Bijn, de Cosmic Life. Onze hypnosekoning Edwin Selei. De lichtwerker Tijn Tauber. En de Breathwork Master Casper van der Meulen. Ik noem er maar een paar. Maar je hoort al, dit is krachtig. En sowieso, samen, elke ochtend, elke avond, even mediteren. Ja, dat wordt echt een training en een mooi moment, denk ik. Meld je aan via koekeroe.nl/meditatie. Dus koekeroe.nl/meditatie.